For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today we hear from the winner of the Booker Prize and bring you more from this year's Wigtown Book Festival. Founder of The Big Issue, Lord Bird, reveals how learning to read saved him from a life of crime.
One of the screws, realising I couldn't read, gave me a book and a pencil, and he said, underline all the words that you don't know.
Journalist Melanie Reed discusses coming to terms with disability and recording her memoir as a talking book.
By the end of the day, I was slumped in a little heap, my shoulders full, and I could hardly get a breath. Talking is very tiring.
And Professor Steve Jones shares some fascinating facts about the vital role the sun plays in all our lives.
Well, I think the most important thing about the sun in our life is without the sun, there wouldn't be any life at all.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. But first, there was a dramatic plot twist to the Booker Prize this week. To gasps of astonishment from the dinner guest gathered at London's Guildhall, Chair of Judges Peter Florence announced that the jury was flouting the rules and there would be two winners this year. He and the four other judges could not decide between The Testaments by Margaret Atwood and Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo. And so the £50,000 prize and the title of winner of the 2019 Booker Prize would be shared between the two authors. Whilst both were clearly delighted, Margaret Atwood admitted that she was very surprised and didn't really need the attention, or indeed the money, which she will be donating to a charity for Indigenous authors in Canada. Bernardine Evaristo, who became the first black woman to win the prize in its 51-year history, said she hoped it would inspire others. She plans to use her prize money to pay off her mortgage. It's not the first time the prize has been shared, but after the second time in 1992, when The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje and Sacred Hunger by Barry Unsworth shared the honours, the organisers changed the rules so that only one winner could be chosen. However, in a move that he said was inspired by the Extinction Rebellion protests taking place just up the road from Guildhall, Chair of Judges Peter Florence and the jury effectively staged a sit-in, refusing to choose between the two novels. We've had both Margaret Atwood and Bernardine Evaristo on the show during the last few weeks, and you can hear the full interviews by heading to our Audio Boom page. But here's a taste of both Margaret Atwood and Bernardine Evaristo's books and what they have to say about them.
It's called Girl, Woman, Other, and it's about 12 primarily black British women, and they are aged 19 to 93, and they come from different cultural backgrounds. They are of different classes and sexualities. They have different occupations. They are of different generations, obviously, because they're aged 19 to 93. And what I wanted to do with the novel was to explore a wider expanse of black British womanhood than we would normally encounter in fiction. So I call the novel a fusion fiction in the sense that each woman has her own section, but all the stories in some way or other are fused with each other's stories. So I have four mothers and daughters in the novel. And I have women who are also friends of some of the leading characters and also colleagues. And the overall effect is this interlinked network of women who in some way are related to or shaped by or inform each other. And it was 5 years in the writing, and I called it Girl, Woman, Other because, apart from one character who's no longer living, with each woman, we meet her in the novel at the age she is when the novel opens, which is in contemporary society today. But we also go back into their past and childhoods to a greater or lesser extent. So we see the women as women. We see them as girls. And the reason I called it Other is because often women are othered in society. Black women are definitely othered in society. But the women are also othered maybe because of their class or because of their sexuality or because of the country that they might have come from. And the women also other each other in the sense that they're not all necessarily going to approve of each other. So there are a couple of characters who you might consider to be homophobic, and then there are characters who are on the homosexual spectrum. So it's a novel full of lots of different things going on.
Amma takes a sip of her Americano, with its customary Kickstarter extra shot in it, as she approaches the brutalist grey arts complex ahead. At least they try to enliven the bunker-like concrete with neon light displays these days, and the venue has a reputation for being progressive rather than traditionalist. Years ago, she expected to be evicted as soon as she dared walk through its doors. A time when people really did wear their smartest clothes to go to the theatre and look down their noses at those not in proper attire. She wants people to bring their curiosity to her plays. Doesn't give a damn what they wear. As her own sod-you style anyway, which has evolved, it's true, away from the cliché denim dungarees, Che Guevara beret, PLO scarf and ever-present badge of two interlocked female symbols. Talk about wearing your heart on your sleeve, girl. These days she wears silver or gold trainers in winter, fail-self Birkies in summer. Winter, it's black slacks, either baggy or tight, depending on whether she's a size 12 or 14 that week, a size smaller on top. Summer, it's pattern harem pants that end just below the knee. Winter, it's bright asymmetric shirts, jumpers, jackets, coats. Year-round, her peroxide dreadlocks are trained to stick up like candles on a birthday cake. Silver hoop earrings, chunky African bangles, and pink lipstick are her perennial signature style statement.
Anna Maria Nabiri narrating Girl, Woman, Other, written by Bernardine Evaristo. Few books have been as eagerly anticipated as The Testaments, Margaret Atwood's sequel to her 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale. Its publication came with a fanfare reminiscent of that given to Harry Potter, with bookshops opening at midnight and costumed characters from the book mingling with fans eager to get their hands on a copy.
First of all, yes, there had been many requests for a sequel, which I'd always said no to, because I understood it to mean that it would be a continuation of the narrative voice of Alfred in The Handmaid's Tale, and there was no way I could recreate that. However, as time moved on, and instead of moving further away from Gilead, we started moving towards it, particularly in the United States, I re-examined that position and decided that although I could not continue with the story of Alfred, I could continue with three other people concerned in these events and tell the story of the beginning of the end. Because we know from The Handmaid's Tale that Gilead vanishes. It's no longer present 200 years into the future because they're having a symposium on it. And we know that when they're having a symposium on something, it's done. It's over. So how did it collapse? How did these kinds of regimes disappear? And they can disappear in various ways. So I was interested in exploring that, and also in exploring what it would be like for the second generation. Because second generations in revolutionary regimes are quite different from first generation.
And it's all that they know.
That's all they know. That's normal life to them. But also they're not engaged in the violent part of the affair. A form of order has been restored. There's some way in which this thing functions, and that's what they grow up within. So one of the narrators grows up within Gilead. One of them grows up across the border in the place where you escape to when things go pear-shaped in the United States, and that would be Canada.
We're all ready to go.
It has always been that way. And therefore we see Gilead from within, from without, and from a founder.
Only dead people are allowed to have statues. But I have been given one while still alive. Already, I am petrified. This statue was a small token of appreciation for my many contributions, said the citation, which was read out by Aunt Vidala. She'd been assigned the task by our superiors and was far from appreciative. I thanked her with as much modesty as I could summon, then pulled the rope that released the cloth drape shrouding me. It billowed to the ground. And there I stood. We don't do cheering here at Ardua Hall, but there was some discreet clapping. I inclined my head in a nod. My statue is larger than life, as statues tend to be, and shows me as younger, slimmer, and in better shape than I've been for some time. I am standing straight, shoulders back, my lips curved into a firm but benevolent smile. My eyes are fixed on some cosmic point of reference, understood to represent my idealism, my unflinching commitment to duty, my determination to move forward despite all obstacles. Not that anything in the sky would be visible to my statue, placed as it is in a morose cluster of trees and shrubs beside the footpath running in front of Ardua Hall. We aunts must not be too presumptuous, even in stone. Clutching my left hand is a girl of 7 or 8, gazing up at me with trusting eyes. My right hand rests on the head of a woman crouched at my side, her hair veiled, her eyes upturned in an expression that could be read as either craven or grateful. One of our handmaids, and behind me is one of my pearl girls, ready to set out on her missionary work. Hanging from a belt around my waist is my taser. This weapon reminds me of my failings. Had I been more effective, I would not have needed such an implement. The persuasion in my voice would have been enough. As a group of statuary, it's not a great success. Too crowded. I would have preferred more emphasis on myself. But at least I look sane. It could well have been otherwise, as the elderly sculptress, a true believer since deceased, had a tendency to confer bulging eyes on her subjects as a sign of their pious fervor. Her bust of Aunt Helena looks rabid, that of Aunt Vidala is hyperthyroid, and that of Aunt Elizabeth appears ready to explode. At the unveiling, the sculptress was nervous. Was her rendition of me sufficiently flattering? Did I approve of it? Would I be seen to approve? I toyed with the idea of frowning as the sheet came off, but thought better of it. I am not without compassion. "Very lifelike," I said. That was 9 years ago. Since then, my statue has weathered. Pigeons have decorated me. Moss has sprouted in my damper crevices. Votaries have taken to leaving offerings at my feet. Eggs for fertility. Oranges to suggest the fullness of pregnancy. Croissants to reference the moon. I ignore the breadstuffs. Usually they have been rained on. But pocket the oranges. Oranges are so refreshing.
The Testaments by Margaret Atwood is available now from the RNIB Library in Braille, giant print, and as TB24921. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. In a moment, we'll make a return visit to Wigtown. But first, talking of the Booker, there was one author that eluded us until the morning of the ceremony, and only because he was touring the US. Salman Rushdie's novel Quixote reimagines Don Quixote set in contemporary America. Sir Salman Rushdie, welcome to RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you.
Could you just set the scene for us?
Yes, I mean, it's a story about a somewhat crackpot traveling salesman who we first meet in the southwest of the United States, in Gallup, New Mexico, who has had his brain turned a little bit by watching too much television and has conceived what he calls a love for a woman on TV, a very famous talk show host that he has obviously never met, and decides to go on a quest across America to win her hand, accompanied by a teenage, somewhat mutinous teenage son whom he calls Sancho, who he's actually wished into being, literally by wishing upon a star. So he's arrived by kind of surrealist means. Then there's a second narrative, which we rapidly discover is the story of the writer who is ostensibly writing the Quixote storyline, who has his own difficulties. You know, he has family problems, which he's trying to resolve. He has an estranged son and a sister with whom he's quarreled. And he's trying to heal those wounds, and those preoccupations find their way into the story he's writing, in which there's also a father-son relationship and a brother and sister relationship. So the two storylines, as it were, talk to each other, and I hope illuminate each other, and gradually merge as the book goes on.
And it's very much about the blurring of boundaries between reality and unreality, truth and fiction, which is reflected in Quixote's addiction to reality TV, which is
not quite as real as we might be being led to believe.
Exactly. Well, reality TV, of course, is anything but reality. It's highly massaged and manipulated reality, and yet it presents itself as the truth. And I think, in the book, it became like a comic figure of that kind of manipulation that's going on all around us these days. And I suppose, although the book is written in a largely comic voice, underneath that comedy is the idea that if you actually live in a world in which that boundary between truth and lies is blurred, that's problematic. It's problematic for us, and it can lead to various kinds of personal and social derangement.
As you said, there's a lot of magical realism to the book, which is a trademark of your writing. But I think what I noticed was in our reality TV world, suddenly magical realism doesn't seem quite such a leap of imagination anymore.
No, I mean, I think, you know, the world is so strange now that I think in a way the novel has to decide how strange it has to be in order to truthfully reflect the strangeness of the world. And that old-fashioned realism, in a way, can't grapple with the unrealism that surrounds us every day.
Yes, and one of your characters, Selma, is a third-generation cultural influencer. She's a TV star. She's made her career as an actress and now presents reality TV. And I felt there was more than a hint of, well, the sky is the limit for the reality TV star. Who knows? They might become president of the United States.
Exactly. Exactly. We do live in that age in which celebrity has replaced other forms of kind of qualification for high office. The thing about Selma that I thought was important is that, you know, Quixote sees her on TV and he sees her as this kind of goddess-like figure. You know, she's beautiful, she's successful, she's powerful, she's rich, she's famous. She's obviously way out of his league. But as we come to know about her, we discover that behind the television, as it were, her life is quite sad. You know, she's a child and grandchild of a mother and grandmother who suffered from clinical depression, and she fears it in herself as well. She has a kind of bipolar syndrome. She becomes dependent on painkillers, on strong opioids. And so there's a kind of deep problem in her, which, of course, he, seeing only the surface, the brilliant surface, is unable to perceive. But I wanted there to be that doubleness in her, you know, the extraordinary public persona and the much sadder private persona.
And, of course, she needs him. She needs people like him to worship her and, well, without giving any plot spoilers, she needs him in another way. But I understand that you did your due diligence and sat and watched hours of reality TV. Did it addle your brain?
It came close to it, I'll tell you that. I could feel the addling beginning. But I watched enough of it that I could write about it, you know, and it would be untrue to say that it's all appalling. Some of it is ludicrously enjoyable because it's so terrible. There's a kind of pleasure in watching absolutely terrible things that don't know how terrible they are.
Another of your characters' brother is a halfway decent spy writer, who one of whose series has become a sort of HBO-type series. I did wonder whether this book actually would make a very good TV series. Are there plans for one?
Well, there aren't yet, but I mean, I'm talking to my Hollywood agents, as they say, who are trying to pitch it, so we'll see if somebody picks it up. I mean, the spy thing, the spy writer part of the book, I mean, I think actually you could possibly lift that out of the book and make that into a spy series, but we'll see. I mean, there's a bit of me that always wanted to write a spy novel, and this is probably as close as I'm going to come to doing one.
It's a super satire, and I also got the impression that it was very good fun to write. It gallops along.
I really wanted it to go at a fast rate. I mean, one of the writers I really admired was the Italian writer Italo Calvino, and he once wrote a series of essays about what he thought were the highest qualities of fiction. And two of them I really responded to, one of which was swiftness, and another was lightness. And I thought, yes, that's a very good way to think about this book. It should move swiftly, and that its manner should be light, even if its material is dark.
I found it actually surprisingly optimistic for a book that deals with sibling rivalries, opioid addiction, and the rotting of the common consciousness by reality TV.
Not to mention the end of the world.
Well, there is that as well.
Can you only be optimistic about the world in fiction, or is it an underlying optimism that you have?
No, I think what happened is that the character of Quichotte, who is a ludicrous optimist, I mean, he's hopeful even when there's really no grounds to be hopeful. He's hopeful about love. He feels that he will attain the hand of the fair lady and that love will find a way. He's hopeful about America, even though he encounters all kinds of reasons to doubt that hopefulness. And I think in a way his optimism has something to do with mine. I mean, I think I'm by nature not a despairing person. I don't necessarily believe that the worst that could happen will happen. And I decided to take that quality of my own, which people sometimes make fun of me for, and magnify it into kind of epic comic proportions. That's what became the character of Quichotte. So I think he is he's me writ large.
And rather like Quichotte, you have embarked on a tour of America. How's the book being received over there?
Oh, I mean, it's done very well. I'm happy to say. And what is nice is that, you know, now that it's been out for, you know, whatever it is, 6 weeks or so, a lot of readers are telling me that they find it to be my funniest book, but that as well as the funny, there's also a kind of seriousness in it. And I think I'm glad that people see those two sides to it, because I wouldn't want it just to be thought of as a wild comedy, although its manner is predominantly comic.
And of course, it's also been shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Midnight's Children, of course, won in 1981 and has twice been voted the Booker of Bookers. Do you hold out the same hope for Quichotte?
Oh, you know, I think you can't. You just can't make any plans about the Booker Prize. I mean, you put five judges into a room and ask them to elect a pope, and essentially anything can happen. So I'm just going along for dinner, you know, and I'll see some friends and que sera, sera.
But still as excited, presumably, to be shortlisted.
Yes, because it's been a long time, you know. I mean, the last time that I was shortlisted for the Booker was 24 years ago for The Moor's Last Sigh. So it's been almost a quarter of a century since I was a part of this. So yes, it's kind of, it is exciting.
Now, those of us who can't read the physical copy, the print copy, have access to the wonderful audiobook version narrated by Vikas Adam. Did you have anything to do with selecting him?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I mean, it's now actually the third of my books that he's done. 4 or 5 years ago, 6 years ago, maybe, I get sent tapes of half a dozen people to listen to in order to say which ones I like. And the moment I heard his, as it were, audition tape, I thought, this is the guy, you know. And he's done a wonderful job. He did the audiobook of my novel 2 Years, 8 Months and 28 Nights, and then he did The Golden House, and now he's done Quichotte. So he's really become my audio voice, you know, and does it better than I could. Is able to find voices for all the different characters, including talking Italian crickets.
His ear for the female voices is particularly good. It always makes me giggle.
Yes, it's really, really good. I mean, so he's terrific, you know, and I couldn't wish for a better voice to be doing these books.
And I know you've had problems with your eyes yourself. You must be delighted that you can reach a blind and partially sighted audience.
Of course, you know. I mean, I've been struggling for a number of years with the condition of what's called macular degeneration in one of my eyes. I mean, it seems to be held at bay, but I mean, I understand very well the problems that can come with the loss of eyesight. And yeah, I'm very glad that the book is available in a form that can reach those readers.
The author of the preceding narrative, we will call him Brother. This is partly because his relationship with his estranged sibling, Sister, will be central to his story, but also for another reason, which will be given later. Was a New York-based writer of Indian origin who had previously written 8 modestly unsuccessful spy fictions under the pen name of Sam Duchamp. Then, in a surprising change of direction, he conceived the idea of telling the story of the lunatic Quichotte and his doomed pursuit of the gorgeous Miss Selma R, in a book radically unlike any other he had ever attempted. No sooner had he conceived this idea than he became afraid of it. He could not at first fathom how such an eccentric notion had lodged in his brain, and why it insisted so vehemently on being written that he had no choice but to start work. Then, as he thought about it further, he began to understand that in some fashion that he did not as yet fully grasp, Quichotte, the loner in search of love, the loser nobody who believed himself capable of winning the heart of a queen, had been with him all his life, a shadow self he had glimpsed from time to time in the corner of his eye, but had not had the courage to confront. Instead, he had written his commonplace fictions of the secret world, disguised as someone else. He now saw that this had been a way of avoiding the story that revealed itself to him in the mirror every day, even if only in the corner of his eye. His next thought was even more alarming. To make sense of the life of the strange man whose latter days he was setting out to chronicle, he would have to reveal himself alongside his subject, for the tale and the teller were yoked together by race, place, generation, and circumstance. Perhaps this bizarre story was a metamorphosed version of his own. Quichotte himself might say, if he were aware of Brother, which was impossible, naturally, that in fact, the writer's tale was the altered version of his history, rather than the other way around, and might have argued that his imaginary life added up to the more authentic narrative of the two. So, in brief, they were both Indian-American men, one real, one fictional, both born long ago in what was then Bombay, in neighboring apartment blocks, both real. Their parents would have known each other, except that one set of parents was imaginary, and would perhaps have played golf and badminton together at the Willingdon Club and sipped sunset cocktails at the Bombay Gym, both real-world locations. They were about the same age, at which almost everyone is an orphan, and their generation, having made a royal mess of the planet, was on its way out. They both suffered from physical complaints, Brother's aching back, Quichotte's dragging leg. They met friends, real, fictional, and acquaintances, fictional, real, in the obituary columns with increasing frequency. There would not be less of all this in the days to come.
Vikas Adam, narrating Quichotte, written by Salman Rushdie, which is TB24923. And thanks to the generosity of the Booker Foundation, Quichotte, like all the shortlisted books from this and previous years, is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. It's been a busy month. As regular listeners will know, producer Robert Kirkwood and I have just returned from the Wigtown Book Festival, where, among others, we caught up with journalist Melanie Reed and leading geneticist Professor Steve Jones. They're both coming up later, but first, in 1991, John Bird, now Lord Bird, founded The Big Issue, a magazine that has transformed the lives and public perception of homeless people in Britain and abroad. Born in a West London slum, he credits literacy with giving him a way out. He's now launched a new magazine, Chapter Capture, aimed at helping others broaden their horizons. And he was at the Wigtown Book Festival to spread the word.
The idea behind Chapter Capture is I always describe it as the dumbest magazine ever invented, because when you read it, no one gives you any advice. You open the magazine, it's crammed full of 40 or 50 chapters, and you browse. And you might say that rubbish, 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 rubbish. Oh, I like that. And it's to actually get people to stop misusing their education, because a lot of people get into, you know, they get into literacy, but then when something happens like Brexit, they're ill-informed. So they make a decision, a wrong decision, a right decision, a left decision, a right, all sorts of stuff like that. So I'm very, very interested in trying to create a cognitive democracy where people learn to read deep, broad and wide so they can think deep, broad and wide. We are entering a world which is getting increasingly complex. As I said on the stage today, a child entering school at the age of 10, by the time they enter the workforce at 21, 60% of the jobs they're likely to get have yet to be invented. We can't just mumble along and bumble along with a form of capitalism that doesn't work for everybody, that doesn't reach the parts that need to be reached. And I believe it's all around education. I believe that if we can change the education, and that means converting people who already can read to use their reading to think deeper so that they then can start making decisions in what I call a cognitive democracy.
Thinking deeper and wider. And it was literacy that actually saved you from, well, a rather binary outcome. You were having trouble with the police and your life.
No, they were having trouble with me. I was quite happy to have nothing at all to do with them, but they found me very attractive. What it was I couldn't read and write. I went to a good Catholic school where they didn't really teach you anything that was useful for work and all that, and I just managed to. They didn't pick up on the fact that I was kind of probably borderline dyslexic, that I could read parts of a sentence but not understand its meaning. And it was really when I got into a boys' prison at the age of 16 for stealing a car and smashing it up at 102 miles an hour without a safety belt. I have to say, I wouldn't recommend it. By the time I got there, I was kind of champing at the bit. I wanted to do something. And one of the screws, realising I couldn't read, gave me a book and a pencil, and he said, underline all the words that you don't know. So I then, over the next couple of months, it was the first time I could admit to people, I carry books, I read bits, I read here, I struggle, it's a foreign language to me. And this was the first man ever, adult, who shone his light on me and said, I'll help you. And it was absolutely brilliant. But unfortunately, I still kept getting into trouble for probably another 10 years. But when I got straightened out, I was a well-read boy and I was a well-read man. And I've stayed, I write books now and all that stuff. And I spend all of my life around bookshops and libraries, you know, in my spare time. And I promote them. My new magazine, Chapter Catcher, is about driving footfall to bookshops and driving usage to libraries. If you don't use the libraries, then the local authority will cut it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't use the bookshops, if you don't buy the books, you can go and demonstrate. I've been on demonstrations where I've asked people, when did you last go to a bookshop? And most of them go occasionally. Mm-hmm. You don't campaign for something if you're not going to deliver. So it's thinking into action.
And I mean, bookshops and libraries are community centres. It's where people from different walks of life actually find out what they've got in common. They meet and they share ideas. The new magazine is going to be a mixture of fiction, non-fiction, and I believe some new writing as well.
Yeah, what I want to do is I want to shine a light on those people who are working on books or got stuck on a book but who've written a couple of chapters, or maybe they've written the whole and they can't find a publisher but they'd like to share their work with us. So we've got a section called In Process. We've got another section that looks at writing in prisons because we, as an ex-offender, I love the idea that you can actually go into a prison and actually encourage people to read. Unfortunately, according to the latest Howard Lee report, you're worse off now than you have been in 50 years when it comes to libraries. I brought a colleague along with me who is a prison librarian and a therapist, and she's involved in something called bibliotherapy, where you use reading to help you straighten your life out. And it's absolutely brilliant that there are the people there. But we don't have government will, and we don't have governors who are necessarily. Some of them are brilliant. I went to a festival, a literary festival in a prison down in Wiltshire a couple of months ago to give a talk. It was absolutely marvellous. The governor, 100%. So it can be done, but you have to rely on the generosity and thoughtfulness of the governor. And the governor saw the redemption or rehabilitation possibilities of teaching people to read and broaden their reading.
One of the things we're very lucky to have with the RNIB is, of course, the largest accessible library, I think, in Europe. Obviously, making books and reading as accessible to as many people as possible, including the print disabled, is very important. Is Chapter Capture going to be available as a talking magazine?
I won't lie to you, it never occurred to me. I'm blind to certain things, even now. I'm blind to many, many possibilities, and like many people, I can be very progressive in some areas and not very knowledgeable in other or even useful. And it's the first time anybody's asked me, and I will go back and we will do it. I had a friend for many years. He used to do, I think it was talking, he would go every week or twice a month, and he would do the talking library. He was the engineer and he put it all together. This was, I think it was the London, some London university, and he did it in his spare time. He absolutely loved it, and people would come in and read for hours, and he'd just make sure all the sounds and all that stuff. Unfortunately, he's not with us anymore, but I will look at who I can tap into, and maybe I'll go to the King's Cross office of RNIB, and I will do that. And it would be brilliant to actually have a situation where you could, in a sense, enjoy this browsing mechanism. So you get a chapter and you say, I don't like that. Oh, I love that. And that is one of the beauties of what we're doing. It's available really to everybody, but we've got to increase that. And thank you for asking me to do it, and I'll get on with it.
Thanks again to Lord Bird. And of course, Read On will bring you news about the recording of Chapter Capture and his book, The Necessity of Poverty, as it comes. Also appearing at Wigtown was Melanie Reed. 10 years ago, the successful journalist broke her neck and back in a horse riding accident. Her weekly column for The Times magazine, Spinal Column, charts the ups and downs of adjusting to life as a tetraplegic, and her memoir, The World I Fell Out Of, has recently been recorded by the RNIB as a talking book. She told me more.
Melanie Reed, you are one of the very, very few disabled voices in the mainstream media, and you've written a very frank account of your disappearance down the rabbit hole into disability, as you referred to it. Did it take a lot of soul-searching before you put fingers to keyboard?
There was no soul-searching at all in the beginning. It was a life raft which was offered to me. Immediately I felt the need to tell people, I suppose the journalist in me, just desperately wanted to tell people what an extraordinary experience it was. I couldn't believe that. It was kind of like a sense of, who knew? This is what it's like, having a catastrophic accident and being in hospital and being in an MRI tube. And I felt in the beginning like a war correspondent from the front line of my own wrecked body. And it was a life raft. I think the ability to write, express my grief was profound, a profoundly good therapy for me. It also, let's be realistic, it continued to pay my mortgage, and I was the main breadwinner. It helped keep the family afloat. My husband, my son was at second year at university. So it was massive. The stuff I wrote the first 2 years, I did not read it for another 2 years. I hit send. The stuff went into the ether. And I couldn't have read it because it would have emotionally destroyed me. It was a long time afterwards that I was able to reprocess what I had written down.
You're a very lone voice when talking about things that most people don't want to think about and confront.
Most people in the upper world don't want to think about and confront, but those of us who live in the lower world, who live with some sort of chronic condition or disability, we live with it every day. We eat, sleep, and breathe it. And I have a chance to express some of the frustrations and the joys, not many consolations at all, but some of the frustrations and the ordeals, and just the different, totally different perspective on the world that you have when you aren't physically perfect or physically enabled in the way that others are, the lucky people are, the complacent people, of which I used to be one. And I didn't ever think about what it was like to be one of those people that fill hospital outpatients' waiting rooms, that sit and endure and wait and wait and wait and go back and wait some more. But that is what a lot of our lives consist of now. And I think I tap this valve, if you like, of people who, for whom nothing, life is not perfect. There are huge difficulties and challenges and frustrations and sadnesses. And I guess people, I'm a bit of a conduit. People project onto me some of their own frustrations and their difficulties, and the fact that I battle along week from week, in some way that helps a few people do that, and it helps them keep cheerful. It also, I think what really heartens me is that a lot of fit and able-bodied people say to me, you help me put my life in perspective. And that's huge, because life is so short. Realizing what matters from what doesn't matter is a big, big thing. And I guess a lot of people go to their graves not realizing the difference.
Something else that also comes through, and I think that, you know, certainly has been helpful in my family, is just how tough it can be on the people around you who care or are your carers, and you give them a voice and don't paint yourself as any paragon of virtue in your reactions to them sometimes.
Show me a paragon of virtue who has a chronic condition. We're not saints, we're just normal flawed human beings, and our carers are normal flawed human beings. And I have no, I'm very open, I just say it like it is. I have to be totally honest, and that's what I am. And I so I strip myself kind of bare. I expose quite a lot about everyday life. I describe myself as the queen of pee and poo, because I talk about things that in mainstream papers and things people don't like reading about. But you know, the amount of gratitude I get from people who say, thank God you talk about what it's like living with incontinence and sexual bereavement. You know, these are, it's almost like these are taboos. We've inverted life. The things that should be taboo aren't taboo anymore, and the things that really fundamental things don't get talked about. So I've inadvertently stumbled into this kind of confessional thing where if it helps, great. If it does help people get through life, fine. It also helps me get through life.
How did you find being the narrator of your own book?
It was blooming exhausting, I tell you. They came to my house, your colleague who was the producer, and we did it was a four day week from 9 o'clock until 5 o'clock, and I was shattered. By the end of the day I was slumped in a little heap, my shoulders full, and I could hardly get a breath. Talking is very tiring. But they were great, and it's so clever recording an audiobook the way, you know, you fluff your lines, everybody fluffs their line. The way you just have to go back to the last comma and you start again. The skill is in the editing and the cutting, which is incredible. It was a great experience. It was a completely novel experience, and I enjoyed it, yeah.
I was happy. I do remember that, although those were the days when I rarely stopped long enough to appreciate it. Isn't it always the same old story? That hindsight is the teacher who always arrives too late and says, I told you so. We're always blissfully ignorant and complacent leading up to life-changing events. So, how to pin down those hateful seconds which I will gnaw regretfully over for the rest of my life? One moment I was cantering towards a small to medium-sized cross-country jump, relishing the unity with my own, my very own, lovely, handsome chestnut champion, the Wonder Horse, high on the hill and the thrill and the freedom and the wind in my face. I was hearing the little girl inside me crying out, "Look at me, look at me." The next moment I was pinned to the ground with a broken neck and fractured lower back. I was conscious throughout. I knew it was catastrophic. I said, "Ow!" to myself when my face slammed into the turf, and then I experienced a blinding red flash and felt my whole body suffuse with a most beautiful, intense feeling of warmth. My own internal nuclear explosion. My own terrible mushroom cloud. In those seconds, I was already aware that my life as I knew it had ended.
Melanie Reed narrating her memoir, The World I Fell Out Of, which is TB704060. And finally today on Read On, Professor Steve Jones is an eminent biologist and geneticist. His infectious enthusiasm for his subject is communicated through his award-winning books and regular appearances on TV and radio. His latest book, Here Comes the Sun, is full of fascinating facts about our nearest star and the vital role that it plays in our lives. After a brilliant appearance at Wigtown, I asked Professor Jones what the most important thing about the sun was.
Well, I think the most important thing about the sun in our life is without the sun, there wouldn't be any life at all. And the book is, in fact, about more than just health, but health plays an important part in it. I mean, what's quite surprising, really, is that when I was, I'm 75 years old, and when I was young, very young, up to the age of 10 or so, everybody assumed almost automatically that sunlight was good for you. Okay, and in fact, in retrospect, they were right. And one of the reasons that view was so prevalent was there had been, in the previous 20 years, enormous success in treating the bone disease, rickets, with sunlight and with vitamin D, which is what sunlight makes when it falls on the skin. And in the 1940s, by the end of the 1940s, rickets, which had been really prevalent among city children in Scotland and England, in fact all over Northern Europe, had been driven out. And that was the most amazing public health success. And as part of that process of driving out rickets, children were forced into the sun, they were forced to take cod liver oil, which has rickets in it, milk was fortified and all this kind of stuff. And that sort of entered the consciousness that you have to go out into the sun. But then, I don't know when it happened, but when people began to move to take holidays in really sunny places, they discovered sunburn, which is definitely bad for you. They discovered it ages skin, and they discovered, or it was already known, that it can cause melanoma, skin cancer. And some skin cancers are very aggressive and dangerous skin cancers. There's no question of that. And if you have them and they're not caught in time, they will be lethal. And there is a strong relationship with sun exposure. So that's certainly true. But even in sunny places like Australia, malignant melanoma is rare. But while many other diseases, from rickets to multiple sclerosis to different kinds of cancers to infectious diseases, are common. Okay, and it turns out in the last decade or so that sunlight, in part through its ability to make this magic vitamin D, has spectacular effects on reducing the risks of things like breast cancer, things like prostate cancer, things like multiple sclerosis, things like mood disorders like depression. This first became obvious when you looked at the incidence of these diseases in tropical countries, like places like Singapore with good health services, versus northern European countries which have good health services but no sun, and the incidence of such conditions in the north is often 4 or 5 times higher than it is in sunny places. Now that's become well established, and people are beginning to take vitamin D, which I think is, for most people, quite a good idea.
And you were telling us that actually the vitamin D supplements that we take come from quite a surprising place.
Yes, I didn't know myself. I mean, I started taking these vitamin D pills when I was writing the book. I thought, oh, come on, there's something in this. And I assumed that they came from a giant chemical factory with, huge steaming vats and secret ingredients. Nope, they come from sheep. And sheep wool, sheep's wool, is covered with lanolin. And farmers have long known that lanolin softens the skin and so on. And you actually see shampoo and skin cream with lanolin in it. But the thing which is amazing about lanolin is that if you shine sunlight or ultraviolet light onto sheep, onto lanolin, it makes huge amounts of vitamin D. So all those little pills you get originally came from sheep wool. Which I think is the most startling thing I discovered while I was researching this book.
What really came through about this is really observational science. This is scientists seeing what a lack of sunlight will do to people, or what a lot of sunlight will do to people, and getting those numbers together and then extrapolating from there to come up with, well, sometimes to prove what might have been written off as old wives' tales, but actually to make some fairly big scientific leaps of faith.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think it's fair to say that many people, many doctors in particular, are far less enthusiastic facilitators of vitamin D than perhaps I am. And what they point out quite accurately is that in most cases, people who have, shall we say, multiple sclerosis or prostate cancer, treating them with vitamin D makes no difference. Okay. Now, I agree, that's true. And the same is true with bone fractures. People who have got brittle bones, adults, treating them with vitamin D seems to make very little difference. But that's a twofold issue. Part of the first issue is that many of the people who are treated with vitamin D have already got reasonably high levels of vitamin D. So once you get up to this threshold level, pushing yourself above this level doesn't make that much difference. So you should be concentrating on the large part of the population that doesn't have vitamin D. And that's not controlled for. But I think a more important point, which I didn't actually bring up in the talk, is a thing I did mention in the talk, and it's rather a delicate subject up here in Scotland, of course, is the Scottish male life expectancy is 2 years less than English male life expectancy. And in the last 40 years or so, although in both countries the male life expectancy has gone up by almost a decade, the two-year gap is still there. Okay. And the interesting and rather alarming fact is that if you take teenagers who've moved, Scottish teenagers, who've moved with their families to England or to a sunnier country at the age of 16 or so, they have the same risk of these diseases as Scottish teenagers who stayed in Scotland. Mm. And it's noticeable that the rickets effect, the soft bone effect, was triumphant because it was used on children. So that much of the effect may be overwhelmingly on the formative years. It's then when you're between 0 and 16 that you set your adult fate. And that's becoming more and more clear. If so, that's a bit depressing, and it means that all those adults like me, and perhaps some of the audience in future who decide to take supplements, may not do them much good, but it won't do them any harm.
And as you said, it's not just physical illness, it's also mental illness. There is something in seasonal affective disorder, and sunlight is a happy drug, for want of a better word.
Yes, that's true, and that's clearly true. What it does, it makes various things like the hormone serotonin, which is sometimes rather flippantly referred to as the happiness hormone. It makes opioids, and these are mood drugs, which are, for example, people who are obsessive runners, they get a flush of opioids, and they are addictive. They are like heroin. They're not as addictive as heroin is, but if you're a really keen runner, you will know the feeling when you've hit the wall when you're running. Okay, and they change mood. And when you go out in the sun and lie out in the sun, you tend to cheer up, and that's because your chemistry has changed. The ultraviolet makes this stuff in your skin. And there was a very unkind experiment done recently in the United States, where there's a lot of concern by people, women, young girls most of all, who are really obsessed with getting suntans on sunbeds, and they spend pathological amounts of time on sunbeds. Yeah, so they did this really unkind and perhaps even unethical experiment where they took a bunch of these young persons who spent several hours a week or more on a sunbed. And of course you have to pay for that. And they said, okay, we'll give you a free sunbed treatment. And the experiment was to divide them into two groups, one of which lay on a proper sunbed, which produces lots and lots of ultraviolet light, stuff that comes from the sun. And the other of which lay on a doctored sunbed, would produce just as much bright white visible light, but no ultraviolet light. And the effects were quite striking, because that second group, lying on the sunbed after 10 minutes, started to complain. They said there's something wrong with the sunbed. It's not doing its job. And the reason is they were waiting for the opioid rush, to which they were, to put it crudely but accurately, in some ways addicted. And the simplicity of that experiment is quite startling. Actually, you can become addicted to go out in the sun. The question is that a bad thing or a good thing? And the answer is, I don't know the answer.
One thing that I know at the RNIB is a very strong message that we like to put out is quite how harmful sunlight, direct sunlight, can be to your eyes.
That's certainly true. There's no question of that. And that's a straightforward, of course, not entirely, but largely a straightforward mechanical effect. In the same way as lots of ultraviolet wrinkles your skin, because it breaks the bonds between collagen molecules, when it comes to cataract, ultraviolet certainly causes cataract. That's certainly true. It's impossible to deny that. There's also some evidence that ultraviolet in large amounts can also damage the retina, although it has to get through the vitreous humor in the eye first. And the answer is, it's hard to deny that. I worked for a year in a factory when I left school. I had no academic ambitions at the time. I worked in a power station. It's the best thing I can tell you. It's the best thing I ever did in my life. It really gave me a kick to do something else. But I work with all these highly skilled engineers and welders and so on. And the welders, half of them were beginning to lose their sight because they were electric arc welders. And of course, this we're talking in the early 60s here. And they were supposed to wear these thick glasses. Either they didn't wear them, or the glasses weren't thick enough, and so they began to get cataract and so on. And the RNIB is completely right about that. I will be the last person to deny that. But the answer is, wear sunglasses.
Thanks again to Professor Steve Jones. As he says, Here Comes the Sun is currently available in print and ebook. But hopefully that talking book version will be coming out soon. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, that's RedSzell, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.